Peace to the people. We're on the move from the nonsense to the good sense. This is Mike Africa Jr. and this is my podcast here on the Black Love Podcast Network, where we illuminate the struggles of the people, inform the uninformed, and give you nothing but the truth. On the Move is here to disrupt the system and spark a global revolutionary change. The change is what we need. Like Sam Cooke said, the change is going to come. But like Gandhi said, you got to be the change you want to see in the world. And even though Gandhi wasn't perfect, but he said something that was true. And when the power of truth is present, you better respect it. So check this out. Everybody know I'm born and bred right here in Philadelphia. This is something, though, that's happening right now that's really like breaks my heart every time I turn on the news. I stop watching the news because of like some of this type of information. You know, Philly is in the middle of one of the worst gun violence crises ever. According to the city controller's office, there were 418 shooting victims in 2020. 486 fatal shooting victims in 2021, and 29 as of January 19th of this year. But I wanted to talk to somebody who could, you know, provide some insight on this. And so I brought somebody in here today. She's in studio with us today. Joining me is an activist, a motivational speaker, an author who served as a Democratic member of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. She knows a lot about these incidents. She's a Philly person, too. Put your hands together for Movita Johnson-Harrell. Clap it up. This is how we clap in the poetry circles. They be like clicking their fingers. How you doing today?
I am good, Mike. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. I have a saying that I say, it's hard to be better. And that actually brings me to what we do. Activists are known for protesting, right? And I do this thing called Gimme Two. Since we're known for being protesting and all of that, but we're multifaceted. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that we do. So as a way of showing people the different things that we're involved in, I like to say, like, tell me two things that happened this week that made you smile. So the first thing I'll say is I visit Mumia a lot. Mm-hmm. And his interest and his optimism is so strong, it's encouraging. Mm-hmm. I know that he's not doing well. He's had open heart surgery. He had hepatitis C and he has ailments from that. He's a COVID survivor. There's a lot of things happening with him. But when you ask him, how you doing? He said, I'm great. I'm strong. I'm here. You know what I mean? And then that moved me a voice. And it just made me feel good about my life. You know, I mean, I haven't had the easiest life, but I also haven't spent 40 years in prison. Right. And, you know, he has kids, right? Grandkids. He has great grandkids. So to hear his optimism about life and about the future and all of that just made me feel really good. The other thing is we were talking about the community, right? And the things that's going on in the community. And I came by your spot today and took a look at what you're doing and the work that you're doing for the community. And to see this happening in the community is powerful, is positive. And being that I am a person whose mission is to humanize activism, it makes me feel good to see this work that you're doing. Oh. So that's the other thing that I had.
Thank you, Mike. That's so good.
What you're doing is so good. Talk to me. What you got?
Okay.
Give me two.
Well, one thing that made me smile was I went to dinner with a young woman who was previously in a relationship with my son, Dante, who was murdered last year, and I may have a granddaughter that I never met. Yeah, right?
Wow. Yeah.
So that was wonderful. That was amazing.
Congratulations.
Yes.
So you never knew. That means he never knew too, probably.
No, he knew. So
oh, he knew.
Him and this young woman were in and out of a relationship for 12 years. And 6 years ago, they were out and she got into another relationship and she had a child. Mm-hmm. She told this other man that this may be my son's baby. And he said he didn't care. He really wanted a baby and he wanted to raise the baby. And last year, my son actually, you know, said to her, like, if this is my daughter, like, I want to raise my own kid. I don't want somebody else. I mean, listen, for real, my son was the best father I've ever seen in my life. They had just talked about having a paternity test, and she was with my son the week before he died, before we could get a test. And my son mentioned it to me in passing. Mm-hmm. But I think he didn't want to get my hopes up high. And just the universe threw us together. Like, we were both in Puerto Rico at the same time.
What?
I literally met her.
You just happened to be in Puerto Rico at the same time she happened to be in Puerto Rico.
I didn't know this young woman. His friends told me about her after my son passed, told me about the child. And I met her in the airport in Puerto Rico.
How did you know it was her?
Well, we're Instagram followers. Like, she started following me, I started following her, because what I said was I didn't want to pressure the young woman.
And you hold up.
Interesting, right?
You just see somebody in line And boom.
Pretty much. I see this young woman and I said, she looks familiar. And she looked at me and she looked startled. Right? And I didn't pay it any mind. And then she's having this whole conversation with this lady in Spanish because she's Dominican. Come to find out, she was talking about me. But I wasn't paying attention because I can understand Spanish. I can speak Spanish. But she, when I got on the plane, she came over to me and she started crying and she asked me, could she give me a hug? And we started a conversation and we went out to dinner on Saturday.
Oh, that's amazing.
So that was beautiful because here's the thing. I mean, me and my family believe in extended family. So either way, I have another daughter now, right?
Wow.
And may have a granddaughter.
Really, congratulations.
Thank you.
I mean, that's amazing. That's, I can't wait to have grandkids myself.
Yeah.
And like, it's just...
It's a different kind of love, Mike.
Wow, it's hard.
I got a second one. I got a great second
one. Okay, come on.
So while we were at dinner on Saturday, ran into State Representative Donna Johnson Bullock, who was a colleague of mine in the House of Representatives, and she thanked me. And I said, why are you thanking me? Well, we got $15 million more for gun violence prevention in Philadelphia, and it's all because of the work you did, Jovita.
Is that right?
So that was something to smile about. To go to community-based organizations, by the way.
Oh, that's dope. So wait, I don't understand that. So how does that work?
So when I ran for office, I never really wanted to be in office, right?
Okay.
Being a politician was never on my to-do list. I ran for office because I got tired of sitting in front of people that look like me and that don't look like me who wouldn't do anything about the gun crisis that was happening in Philadelphia. So I ran for office to kind of twist people's arms to kind of do something about the situation to address the social determinants that lead to gun violence. First time I ran was in 2016. I didn't win, but I won because I wound up in Krasner's camp, right? Mm-hmm. I wound up as his director for victim services and criminal justice reform. But then when Vanessa Brown resigned in January of 2019 because the city didn't fund the focused deterrence strategy, I said, I'm going to go up to Harrisburg and bring the money back myself. As a 6-month freshman with no history in politics, I went up to Harrisburg and I brought back $1.3 million for gun violence prevention.
Okay.
It's a lot to unpack.
I mean, and we can get more into that, but you mentioned your son.
Yes.
Right. And your son is a victim of gun violence. Do you want to talk about that? Do you want to tell that story?
Yes. I don't know if you know, I'm actually a 5-time co-victim of homicide.
5-time co-victim of homicide?
5-time co-victim. March 30th, 1975, Easter Sunday, my father was shot with a double barrel shotgun in his chest in front of me and my family. I was 8 years old. And then on July 1st, 1991, my only brother was murdered over a girl while his 5-year-old son sat in his lap. He was 28 years old. And then January 13th, 2011, after I left Philadelphia, moved my family away from Philadelphia to get away from the gun violence, my 18-year-old son Charles came into Philadelphia to drop his brother off at work and to pick his sister up. And two boys walked up to the car that I just bought my daughter and put 4 bullets in my son. Then January 1st, 2013, my 5th child in my house, my cousin Stephen Kyrie Johnson, who was about to graduate Fox Temple School of Business, went to a New Year's party that he didn't even want to go to and was being a peacemaker between two boys who were fighting over a girl. And one boy turned around and put a gun to his chest and pulled the trigger. And then this past March 5th, my 30-year-old son Dante, who has been on the front line with me for the last decade, went to California for a weekend trip and was killed in a random drive-by. 6 people were shot. My son was the only fatality. He was shot once in his right eye. So this is my issue. I didn't choose it. It chose me.
I can't. That's...
Both of my sons.
And your dad.
And my dad.
And your brother. You know, I don't even know what to say to that.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry it happened. Just a short while ago, the actor Regina King lost her son.
Yeah, Ian.
Ian, right. You know, just losing a child. Like the other day, I went in my son's bedroom. He was staying over at his cousin's house, just spending the night at his cousin's house. So when I went into his bedroom, he wasn't in it. All his stuff was in it, but he wasn't in it. And I just remember thinking about it. Like, I understood why people move out of their houses.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When one of their, you know, kids, you know, I just, my heart is with you right now. Like, I can't even imagine being in that space.
Yeah.
I think you're the perfect person to talk about these issues of gun violence. Like, what's going on in the city? What is it? I mean, the money that's being funneled into gun violence prevention, like, is it helping, right? What's going on right now is like the record is being broken from the previous year for the last consecutive years, right? Mm-hmm. So how did we get here where we are now?
We didn't even have to get here, Mike.
What do you mean by that?
So here's the thing. In 2021, we had 562 homicides in Philadelphia, up 37% from the previous year. So going back to when we talked about me running for office, right, one of the reasons why I ran was because in 2013 and 2014, I participated in a strategy. It was called the Focus Deterrence Strategy. It was a positive peer pressure model that used the small percentage of people doing the shooting, used them against each other to stop the shooting, right? But what it did was it offered social services, it offered jobs, it offered food, it offered school, whatever they needed. And it was very targeted and very intentional, right? And for me to be invited to be the moral voice of the community for that strategy, because all of law enforcement would get up and speak before me, right? The DEA, the ATF, the AG's office, the district attorney. And these boys are looking at them like, so what? Because they can do a bid. In their mind, they're saying, I could do a bid, right? Mm-hmm. But then when a mother gets up and talks about losing their kid to a case of mistaken identity, well, guess what? All of them know somebody that shouldn't have been murdered, who wasn't a part of the game. Right? All of them have a woman that loves them. So for me to talk to them, I literally watched 40 to 50 young black and brown men every time I sat in front of them transform before my eyes. And here's the thing, when we did the first call-in in April of 2012, they said, no, 2013, they said there were two boys who would never call in for help. They said these two boys came from generations of drugs, generations of guns. They were going to die on the streets of Philadelphia. This is what the police said, right? We did the first call-in in 2013, that April. We went out to dinner to celebrate after the call-in. They were given one number to call if they needed anything. If you needed diapers and milk for your kids, you called this number. If you needed a job, if you needed school, if you needed clothes, if you needed bus fare, you called this number. Well, we're out celebrating hours after the first call-in, and the phone rings. That one number. It was one of those two boys that they said would never call in, that would never put down the guns, that would never come off the street. Mm-hmm. And he called in for help. The next week, that second boy called in for help. And then it was like a trickle effect. They started calling in for help. They started going to Goodwill and getting fork drivers certificates. Some of them enrolled in school. They wanted an out, but there was no door. And we provided a door. So I've literally spent the last 2015 is when it kind of went out of existence. The last 6 years of my life fighting to bring this strategy back to Philadelphia. That was the only reason why I ran for office.
Why can't you get it back?
So I bought the money. I bought back $1.3 million. And I also, when I ran, I wanted there to be a line item on the governor's budget just for gun violence prevention to fund community organizations that are really doing the work, right? But what you got to realize is that gun violence is big business.
Can we back up a little bit?
Yep.
Because you're right. Gun violence is big business, right? Mm-hmm. But just to back up a little bit to clarify for people, there is no line item for gun violence prevention in Pennsylvania?
There is now. Last year, I worked with Donna Bullock. I gave her a piece of legislation to present to the House of Representatives. This was after I resigned from the House. And she actually got that piece of legislation pushed in the lame duck session of the House, which put $24 million just for community-based organizations for gun violence prevention. And this most recent round, this $15 million, is on top of the 24.
Okay, so there's no one solution to this whole gun violence issue. What do you imagine is a start to actually cleaning up some of these issues?
For them to really implement, it was called Focused Deterrence in 2013-14. It's actually called GVI. Group violence intervention, and it's happening all across the country. It's a model that was created by criminologist David Kennedy out of John Jay College in New York City. Everywhere that model goes, they have 30% and more reduction in gun violence.
And is it going to be hard to get that here?
It's supposed to be happening here, but with COVID, so it's a group model, so it brings them all together to give them all the same message. And when I got the money here initially, they couldn't, it was right during the hit of COVID, mm-hmm, right? So mm-hmm. they really couldn't do it the way that it's supposed to be done. But what they did was they modified it into something called custom notification, meaning a group would go to a shooter's house and talk to them and their parents or them and their caregivers to let them know that we know who you are, we know what you're doing, and it's going to stop. Right now, the first real call-in was scheduled for last week, but then we had the Omicron, uh-huh. which actually shut it down because the call-in was scheduled for last week. It's a lot.
It's a lot. So you say gun violence is big business, right? Do you think that gun violence is big business is the reason that 30% is not 80% or 100%, right? Because 30% is a lot. Mm-hmm. But it's actually not a lot because one child being murdered by right. gun violence is too many, right? I'm just trying to wrap my mind around this number, mm-hmm. right? There's a lot of people. And this is just one city, Philadelphia.
So with the strategy, we had over a 30% decrease in gun violence in the strategy in the first year of the pilot.
I'm trying to understand the thing about gun violence or guns being big business. Because uh-huh. gun violence, guns, all of it is big business.
Absolutely.
Police and a lot of people are getting paid off the blood of black people in Philadelphia and all over the country, right? But explain to me what you mean by that for okay. the people out there.
Absolutely. So when you look at the whole picture, right, we talk about just the gun. It's not just about just the gun. So for number one, the gun manufacturers make more than $1 million in guns every year that they know will be sold on the black market. So those are the guns that's being funneled in our communities. We don't make Smith & Wesson in the hood, right? Where are all the guns coming from? That's number one. And the straw purchases and things of that nature, that's number one. But then you look at everything else. So why did the mother of the dead kid have to run for office to bring money back to Philadelphia for gun violence prevention, where in Philadelphia, we're spending billions of dollars to promote gun violence? We're building multi-million dollar trauma bays, right? Look at what Penn Presbyterian did. It tore a whole block up to build a trauma bay just for gun violence. Temple University, gun violence. Look at everybody that's getting paid off of the gun violence, the criminal injustice system, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got judges,
mm-hmm.
you got defenders,
mm-hmm.
prosecutors, parole.
Don't forget about those lawyers.
Right? All of them. Not only that, doctors, nurses, social workers, victim services, everybody profits off of people being harmed. So the one thing that I used to say all the time was, why are we looking to create more victim services when the actuality is we need to be creating less victims? How do you create less victims? You address the social determinants that lead to gun violence. Let's start number one with poverty,
mm-hmm.
right? Let's start with systemic racism.
How does poverty, you know, I mean, I grew up in poverty, right? We grew up in the hood. How does poverty stop gun violence?
Poverty doesn't stop gun violence. It's making sure that people aren't impoverished that stops gun violence. When you're able to provide people with resources and jobs and education and food and the things that they need to be successful, then they're less likely to pick up a gun because they have other options.
So you're saying that this is a systemic issue?
Absolutely.
It is not an accident. It's deliberate.
It's intentionality and it's genocide.
Why would they do this? Because they're just making money?
Why would they not?
It's
always been about money, and it's always been about money at the cost of black and brown skin. Here's the thing. If you look at the big picture, a lot of victims were not happy with me, right? Because when my
victims.
Oh, parents of children who were murdered or parents of children who were shot. Because when we created the Charles Foundation, we were very intentional to create it for those on both sides of the gun.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason why I did that was, now initially when Charles was murdered, the boys who killed my son went on the run and I literally went running after them. I had this bright idea that I was going to go and get licensed to carry and I was going to go find them and murder them. But the boys were caught and we got an opportunity to sit through a 2-week trial. But when a homicide detective, white man, said to me, well, Movita, they called Charles a pure victim. Charles didn't even know these people, right? Well, while Charles was a pure victim, we knew that these boys were going to harm somebody. Like, one of them harmed animals as a child. We had them in and out of juvenile facilities. We had them in and out of adult correctional facilities. Well, at that point, I'm looking at this homicide detective like he has two heads. And what I said to him was, so really, they're not at fault for killing my son. You are.
You said that to the homicide detective?
I did. I said, because If you knew that those two boys were a problem and you didn't give them what they needed to be successful, then the system's at fault. And at that point, we made a decision, and I made a decision, and I had to talk to my family about it before our trial even ended, that I needed to forgive these two boys. And I actually wound up asking for mercy for the two boys who murdered my son at their sentencing. My son's shooting is on video camera from the poppy store on the camera.
Oof.
But the one boy got life in prison without the possibility of parole, and the second boy was going to get 24 to 40 plus two gun charges that carried 7 years each. And the judge literally started crying on the bench. She said, 20 years on the bench, I've never had a mother ask for mercy for her son's killers. Instead of the 24 to 40 in the two gun charges, he got 12 to 24 and the two gun charges dropped. He could parole next year and I wouldn't fight it.
Okay, you know, my parents spent 40 years in prison for a crime they did not commit.
I know.
And Mumi is in prison, been in prison for 40 years. And I know a lot of people that are political prisoners. You know, sometimes their cases are complicated because they may or may not have actually done some of the things that they were accused of. But sometimes it was in response to something or whatever, right?
Right.
And people feel justified because these people did something to their family members or whatever. What should be the way to deal with people in that situation?
So for number one, I mean, if people do crimes, then they have to atone for those crimes, right? But for me, I was more interested in being able to have a conversation with them and finding a way for them to heal beyond incarceration, right? And that was one of the reasons why I went with Krasner into his office to do restorative justice practices. Because in the Black, especially in the Black community, you know, we've been harmed so much that we have trauma running through our DNA,
mm-hmm.
right? And for these young people who didn't get what they needed to be successful and for them to run in and out of the system and still not get what they need to be successful, my thing is, at what point are we going to give them what they need, right? Like, Sean Jones will probably parole next year. Well, what have they done to help him to not harm again? What have they done to help him to be healthy when he comes out on the streets? So we need alternatives to incarceration. And I understand exactly what you're saying. My stepfather, Chuck Logan, is up at what used to be Gratiford. He is at Phoenix. He has been there since 1975 for my father's homicide, and he didn't do it. We were there.
You saw who did it.
We saw who did it. My
and it
mother
wasn't
testified
Chuck Logan.
In court. My brother testified in court. I was 8 years old. They wouldn't let me testify. But they testified in court and they still incarcerated him for my father's homicide.
The thing that's ringing in my head like an alarm is these boys killed your son.
Yeah.
And you're showing them mercy because they didn't get the support and guidance that they needed to not be murderers.
Right.
But why do you care about what happens to them?
Because I'm a Black mother. And here's
I know a lot of Black mothers who would have went through with hunting them down and probably murdering them. Why is that your business to care about them when they did something to your son?
Because in my mind, there is no such thing as other people's kids. They're all our children. So it's all of our responsibility to take care of our children. And listen, if you look at the work that I do in the Charles, that's why I do the work that I do in the Charles Foundation, because I want to prevent the next kid from being on either side of the gun.
I mean, it's really, really important what you're doing, and I appreciate it. It's just hard to, like, even believe. I'm like at a loss for words. I'm not usually at a loss for words. But you just said something that was so profound to me as a person who grew up without parents in the home.
Mm-hmm.
So to hear someone say that is just, it's really touching.
And here's the thing for me, I had to become a parentified child. My father literally died in my mother's arms. And my mother had her own trauma from being abused by her father and, you know, domestic violence. But I literally lost my mother in that moment and my brother, because my mother then began to suffer with depression. She self-medicated with drugs and alcohol. And by the time I was 12 years old, I had to be the parent in the house. So I had a younger sister who was 4 years younger than me, right? And I had to take care of my sister and I had to take care of my mother. And I did what I had to do. I wound up selling drugs. I wound up getting into an active addiction. And I actually have 27 years clean.
Oh, clap it up for that.
Yeah. So, and you talked about the bottom. I'm five generations out of the bottom, right? Mm. Five generations poverty, five generations drug addiction. I've broke those chains.
Mm.
And I did it all for my children. And then for my son to be taken was like the worst thing that the universe could ever do to me, right? And then my second son. And I'm still in shock about Dante. I need to be totally honest. It's still not real. But I keep getting up and I keep putting one foot in front of the other and I keep taking the directives from the universe and I keep just doing the next best thing and I keep just trying to save the next child. And I don't know what else to do, right?
You know, I was watching a video clip of Mike Tyson. He said, sometimes I wake up in the morning and I say, God, are you fucking with me?
That part.
You know what I'm saying?
That part.
Like, what are... I used to do that. I used to wake up in the morning and think to myself, what is going on? And you know what? You know what I've come to? It took me 43 years to come to this. I heard somebody say something and I was so angry. I was so upset because they said this thing and I couldn't accept it. They said, hurt people hurt people.
Yep.
And I said, you know what? Don't say that to me. I said, I'm going to change that. I'm going to change it from hurt people to hurt people heal people. Because you don't have to hurt people just because you've been hurt. If you've been hurt, you should recognize the pain that you feel and should not want to do that to other people. We took the hurt that we felt and decided that we're going to use it as positive energy to help other people, to heal other people.
Yes.
And I love that. Hurt people, heal people. That's the way we should be thinking.
I love that, Mike.
I love what you're doing, man. Like, this is so beautiful. You know, hurt people, heal people. That's the way. You know, what you're doing is so impactful. But I can't even imagine what you've been through. And I just applaud the work that you're doing and the strength and the courage to get up in the morning and put one foot in front of the other every day and keep on moving. You're truly on the move.
I'm parenting four grandchildren.
When you watch the news.
I don't.
You don't watch the news.
I don't. I can't.
And I was going to ask you, like, when you see this stuff happening, how does it make you feel? But you can't. And you know what? I don't watch the news either. Okay. So Philadelphia, what's the plan? How are we going to move the needle from 486 homicide victims to less than that and then eventually none?
I don't think we are. I think we waited too long to get in front of it.
Is there something that we need to do with these gun corporations, these manufacturers?
Absolutely. First and foremost, we need to start suing them.
Right? You can't sue the gun manufacturers.
No, you can't. But actually, so Krasner tried this thing to hold them accountable, but they have too much power. I mean, even if you look at the Trump era, they own the White House.
I heard Trump, after the Parkland shooting in Florida, he said, we're going to take a look at these gun laws and so on, so on, so on. So the NRA looked at him and said, no, you're not.
Yes, that's exactly what they said.
And then he didn't say anything else about it.
Because they own the White House.
Well, what's the solution? Are we just supposed to just accept that our children are just going to be shot and killed every year by the numbers more and more every year?
First and foremost, replace the people who are in office who just worry about keeping the job. That's number one, right? That's why they hated me. That's number one. So what we need to do is we need to be selecting our own candidates, raising money, and getting people out of office who haven't done what they were supposed to do by our communities. That's number one. And here's the thing. I have no hope in politics, for real, for real. So the other thing is we need to make sure that the community groups on the ground who are doing the work, and that's what I fought for, right, was that money was coming into these communities that are most devastated by gun violence. But here's the problem. Now they're just doing what's called throwing shit at the wall to see what's, excuse me.
No, you can curse. We curse all the time. We curse all the time. Throw the shit at the wall and see what sticks.
And that's what they're doing. It's not orchestrated. It's not refined. It's not methodical. They're just throwing money at the political pets and just it's messy and it's a mess and it's not what I fought for. And, you know, then somebody wants to congratulate me for helping bring the money to Philly. Well, that ain't what I bought it for.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And if they were to do it the right way, then we would see the numbers go down. But as long as they do what they're doing, the numbers are not going to go down. You know why? Because they are not addressing what's at the core of the gun violence, because they are not addressing the social determinants that lead to gun violence. They are not addressing the poverty. They are not making sure that we have. Look, when you disinvest in communities of color, this is what you're going to have when you take money out of education, when there is no job training, when there is no auto mechanic school and, you know, plumbing classes and teaching people trades. This is what you're going to have. We have a hopeless situation because we have hopeless people because we haven't given them anything to be hopeful for.
So what you're doing in the community and making sure that you're feeding the people in your community and encouraging them to be good people like you just by your example, right? That has been a very powerful example for people so that they can, you know, recognize this and do something about it, right?
Mm-hmm. I think it's an even bigger part of that, right? Because the work that we do with the children, so we work with kids 13 and 19, and we got this agreement with the Horticultural Society where we do the same day work and pay, and that was just a way to originally get them in, mm-hmm. right, to attract them. But once we got them in, and we found out that what they really wanted was to be cared for, right? So we've become their extended family. Now, since we have them, we engage them. We give them mentorship. We give them education. We give them income. We give them food. And they're prosperous. We got 30 kids from across the city. Half of our kids have been shot. Several of them have been shot at. All of them have lost someone to gun violence. And if I had the capacity to build on this, because I have to turn kids away. For the one thing, the Charles Foundation has never solicited in the 11 years that we've been in existence. We've done everything from the muscle, right? Because I never wanted anybody telling me what I could or could not do with my foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't accept grants. We don't solicit. And I brought a lot of money to Philadelphia, but none of the grants have been for the Charles Foundation. But right now, what I need to find a way to do is to expand on what we're doing with these kids, because I'm finding myself turning kids away because I don't have the capacity.
How can people help?
Give me opportunities for young people. If you have a business and you can hire a young person part-time, and I can connect you to the young person to bring them in. If you want to be a mentor, contact the Charles Foundation and be a mentor to a young person that needs help.
We're talking about this stuff, but this stuff is so deep and insidious and crazy.
Yes. Intentional.
Intentional. I mean, there are so many conversational topics within this conversation.
Yeah, because we didn't even talk about gentrification.
You know what we're going to have to do? We're going to have to set this up and table this one so that we can come back. Because gentrification is a popular topic. A lot of people are talking about it all around the country.
But they're not making a connection to gun violence. And here's the thing. Everything that the controller's doing right now is because she heard me say a speech. And she heard me talk about the zip codes with the highest rates of poverty or the highest rates of gun violence. And she asked her staffer, is that true what Movita said? And he said, if Movita said it, it's true. She went back and researched it and found out that it's true and came to me and said, thank you, because I never knew that.
The first time I heard the word gentrification in relation to violence and gun violence and all of that was on Boys in the Hood. Furious Styles. He said it. He said they want us to kill ourselves.
Yep. And they're pushing them on top of each other so that they can kill each other.
Like I said, we could talk about this like all day. We got to get this information out to people. We got to let people know what's going on. We're going to have to set up another one.
We could do that.
We could set up another one and we'll get a chance to, you know, show some of the work that you're doing and then bring you in so that we can talk about it. And hopefully by then we will not be on pace to break last year's gun violence record.
And we can talk about my book next time.
What's the name of your book?
So the name of my book is Phoenix Ascending, My Rise from the Ashes.
Uh-huh.
And it's a memoir.
Okay.
And I bought a copy just for you.
Thank you very much. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the show and shedding some light on what I know is really painful information to share. Before I let you go, though, tell the people how they can connect with you if they want to talk to you further.
Yes. So I have a website. It is MovitaJohnsonHarrell.com, M-O-V-I-T-A. Johnson Harrell, H-A-R-R-E-L-L.com. Also Facebook, IG, Twitter, all Movita Johnson Harrell.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, that's a wrap. Thank you for listening. If you like what you heard, tell a friend about it. Help them get on the move with me and make sure you review, rate, and subscribe to give me the 5 stars. I need the 5 stars, y'all, so that we can keep this movement moving. No excuses. Spotify got their thing up, so make sure you check us out. I'll see you on the next go round. Peace out. On the Move with Mike Africa Jr. is executive produced by me, Mike Africa Jr., and Tommy Oliver. Produced by Crystal Hill, edited by Masu McLemore, and made for you, the people.